The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the podcast Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Be My Guest is intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends, David Remick, Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, and more. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Yes.
Dr. Remnick.
Sir.
You really, really look like a doctor. Doesn't he look like a doctor?
I do.
If he walks, he's your car. I'm your cardiologist. You would just feel so calm.
Wouldn't you?
Right, yes. How I feel. Oh, I'm in good hands here.
Jerry, it's nothing to worry about. Take a few tests.
Oh, you got the tone.
You know that voice, or I think you do, but for the record, it's Jerry Seinfeld, who came by our studios recently so he could determine, as my mother once did, that I should have been a doctor.
So, what's going on with you and Melanie? I mean, I know you're not getting married.
Seinfeld was famously the show about nothing, or maybe not nothing exactly, but
we kind of broke up.
About very small, very petty things, and the ludicrous amount of mental energy we expend on them.
Well, you know, we were having dinner the other night, and she's got the strangest habit. She eats her peas one at a time. You've never seen anything like it. It takes her like an hour to finish them. I mean, we've had dinner other times. I've seen her eat corn niblets, but she scooped them.
She scooped the niblets?
Yes! That's what was so vexing.
That fixation on the preposterously minor has always been at the core of Jerry Seinfeld's comedy, and it's certainly at the core of Unfrosted, his new movie, which takes a footnote in culinary history, the invention of the Pop-Tart, and treats it like an epic national battle. Now, this isn't Seinfeld's first feature. He wrote the animated B-movie, but Unfrosted is his debut as a director. How did this project, which is hilarious and nuts in many ways, and so it's so funny.
Oh, thanks.
And it resonates with all kinds of things in the 60s and movies about the 60s,
yes,
which we'll get to. How did you decide on this project?
COVID.
You were going out of your mind, weren't you?
Yeah. And my friend Spike Ferriston, the writer who wrote the Soup Nazi episode, we used to joke about making a movie about the Pop-Tart. It was a joke.
The Kellogg's Pop-Tart suddenly appeared out of Battle Creek, Michigan, which, as you cereal fans know, is the corporate headquarters of Kellogg's in a town I have always wanted to visit. Because it seems like a cereal Silicon Valley of breakfast super scientists conceiving of a frosted, fruit-filled, heatable rectangles in the same shape as the box it comes in. And with the same nutrition as the box it comes in, too.
I go, there's no movie here. He goes, give me one meeting. Let's just get the two writers that I love from B-Movie, Barry Martyr, mm-hmm, and Andy Robin. Let's just the four of us do a Zoom and give me one meeting. And Andy Robin says, do you remember the scene in The Right Stuff where Jeff Goldblum and Harry Shearer run down the hall and they burst into the conference room and LBJ's sitting there and they go, it's called Sputnik.
It's called Sputnik.
We know. Sit down.
He goes, "That's what this is." I went, "Oh, yeah."
And as I was saying,
sitting with four comedy writers who love each other's sense of humor, mm-hmm. you know, the first 20 minutes, I do a 20-minute warm-up of just nonsense. What'd you do last night? What'd you eat? Mm-hmm. What'd you watch? You know, and you just start laughing and having fun. This is how comedy is done. You can't have anybody in the room that's not in the same, that doesn't have the same brain disaffect.
What does that mean?
Regular people need courtesies and respect to converse and socialize with them. You can't say hostile things to them, to their face, but comedians love that.
You don't get offended. There's no offense in the room.
The offense is if it wasn't funny. That's the offense.
But never the other person is never offended if you insult them, rag them, or something.
As long as it's funny.
Yeah.
Which usually insulting someone in the face is pretty funny. But we don't think that there is much value in everything else in life. Everything else in life is pretty much a nuisance. But if you can get a laugh out of it, it's worth it. That's the way you go through life. You only care about laughing and being funny.
So describe these meetings to me, how they went during the course of however long they lasted.
They're all the same. They start off with 15 to 20 minutes of absolute nonsense. There's a lot of really vile profanity, complaining about absolutely everything and anything. And then you go, okay, what were we working on yesterday? What was the scene? Where are we going from here? And then you start to write. But you're all kind of, you're in this mood now. And that's how you write comedy. If somebody else walks in the room, everybody, you have to stop. What do you want? Yes, I know. Okay, dinner's fine. It's 6. That's fine. Okay. And you have to, you know, could you please leave?
You experience it as fun or you experience it as work, as effort?
50-50.
Yeah.
It does have to make sense to an audience. That's the work. All you want to do is be totally insane.
In the film, you play a marketing executive for Kellogg, and it's everything is set in 90. It's set in 63.
Right.
JFK is the president. The story centers around this race between the Kellogg Company and
Post. Which was true.
Which is another popular cereal maker. And they're both working toward a trip to the moon. No.
That's right.
They're working toward the creation of Pop-Tarts, right, whether they know it or not. Tell me about how that storyline originated.
Well, the storyline is the true truth of the story, which I have always loved. That Post came up with this idea. Kellogg's heard about it months before they were about to debut it in supermarkets. They freaked out. They go, we have to have the same thing as them. We have to get there before them. We have to make it better than them. And that's what we came up with. It's the right stuff. It's the U.S. versus the Soviet Union to put a man on the moon.
Now, we're of a similar age. We grew up on similar breakfast foods and a lot else. And I have vague memories of Walter Cronkite, who, by the way, has a great role in this movie.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
A drunk, insane Walter Cronkite.
Kyle Dunnigan created a lot of that on the set.
Yeah, very funny.
Direct from CBS News in New York, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
This just handed to me some major news from the breakfast world. The Post Cereal Company of Battle Creek, Michigan, has reportedly invented a shelf-stable, heatable fruit pastry breakfast product. Shelf-stable. Boy.
Did you really like Pop-Tarts all that much growing up?
Oh, yeah.
How about now?
Still, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, love them.
That's a good breakfast for you?
No, I don't eat it for breakfast. I eat it after a bad show on a Wednesday night.
I see. When have you ever had a bad show?
A lot of times. I mean, to me, a bad show is I'm going to do 4 new pieces tonight. If 3 of them tank, it's a frustrating night.
Now, you could do for Pop-Tarts what Barbie did for Barbie. This could be a big thing for them.
Except that Kellogg's did not even know we were doing this.
No.
They did not. We only called them 3 weeks ago
the lawyers,
to tell them, by the way.
The lawyers didn't freak out?
We found a lawyer in the valley.
A guy.
Who said, could you write us a letter saying that this is okay to do, that we can show to Netflix?
Yeah.
Because Netflix, when we pitch them this idea, is going to go, I assume you've checked this all out legally and the clearances. And I go, of course, we have a letter right here.
The guy from the Valley.
Yeah.
He says it's great.
Yeah. He says it's no problem.
So there's no fee paid to Kellogg's or Post?
No.
And no permission given or taken?
No. Do you think—
I think you're in big trouble.
Do you think that Kellogg's would make a movie where people lose their lives— trying to invent a pastry?
Or dive into dumpsters?
Yes.
Two children diving into dumpsters looking for the special fruit paste.
Yeah.
Are your kids okay?
Oh, sure. We live in nice homes and already had a complete breakfast.
But we come here for this.
It's garbage.
Is it? Or is it some hot fruit lightning the man doesn't want you to have?
No, wait. You have to have it like this.
Now, you've got an amazing cast here. Melissa McCarthy, mm-hmm. Jim Gaffigan, mm-hmm. Sarah Cooper, Kristen Wiig.
Hugh Grant.
And Hugh Grant,
mm-hmm.
which he's a little famous for being not so easy on set.
Yeah.
Was that your experience?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Tell me about that.
I love this man. My apologies to all the other people I've met. He's my favorite human.
Hugh Grant.
Yes, he's my favorite human.
What?
He's because his charm and funniness is what I dreamed of when I was a kid in the 60s. I want to be a charming, witty man. That never happened.
You wanted to be Cary Grant?
Yes. Well, yeah. We grew up Muhammad Ali and JFK and Sean Connery. Those are men. We want to be like them, you know. Yeah. They were all witty handsome.
What was it like
and
to
work? Had broad shoulders.
Well, he apparently—
And he has all these things.
He has the broad shoulders,
he
too.
He has the shoulders. He has the wit. He knows how to have fun. He knows how to make people, put people at ease. But a lot of these actors, you know, they're very, they're prima donnas. And he told me he would be. And I go, that's fine. I don't care what you are.
So right off the bat, he said, I'm going to be a pain in the neck.
Yeah, yeah.
And was he?
I don't care. What do I care?
What do you mean?
I don't care if someone's an asshole if they're charming. A charming asshole is way better than a boring, polite person.
So how did it play itself out on set, for example, him being a charming asshole?
I'd say, Hugh, you know, in this scene, you know, you're wearing these sunglasses, and would you be completely against the idea of not wearing sunglasses in the scene? This is a negotiating technique I learned.
Mm-hmm.
The answer you always want to get from your counterpart is no, not yes.
Why is that?
Because people love to say no. They hate to say yes. Saying yes makes you feel vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Saying no makes you feel secure. So you ask a question where the answer you want is no. Hugh, would you be totally against not wearing the glasses? No, I wouldn't be totally against it.
And that's the finesse.
Yeah, that's the finesse.
Now, did you enjoy this new activity of directing? And
with these people, when you have Melissa McCarthy or Hugh or Peter Dinklage,
he has a great turn in the movie.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's like someone saying, how would you like to take this Ferrari out for a drive?
Right.
It can do anything you ask it to do,
mm-hmm.
anything. That is a lot of fun. I mean, he is a thrill. Right now.
Are you a milkman?
The name's Harry Friendly, and you might say I am the milkman. Do you know the first taste a human being experiences at birth?
Applesauce?
Oh. Milk, Mr. Cabana.
Right.
And in the milk business, we are not just part of the American dream. We are the white and the red, white, and blue. We are the cream that rises so famously to the top. And you, Mr. Cabana, have become the annoying white ring that sticks to the bottom.
Jerry, you must get any number of ideas for films either brought to you or you have. No?
Never got an idea. This is the only idea I've ever had for a film.
Really?
I never get asked to do a film.
Really?
Never.
Why the hell would that be?
I don't know. When I was at DreamWorks and we were casting B-Movie, This casting director came in and she had two cards, a blue card and a pink card. On each card were the biggest male stars, and on the pink card were the biggest female stars mm-hmm. in the business at that time. This is 2000s. And we go through the names. By the way, there's like 12 names on each card. That's it.
Right.
And so we were casting the thing, and I, before she leaves, I go, "Let me. Can I ask you, am I on that blue card?" And she says, "No."
Nice.
And I went, "Why not?" And she said, "Because everybody knows you won't do it."
Was she right?
Yeah.
Well, Hamlet maybe, but you wouldn't do any number of other things if the project was right?
You have to realize if you look at my career, I have never succeeded at anything that wasn't my material.
Mm-hmm.
Not one time. I've only done it once, and it was a huge failure. When I did Benson in 1980.
Yeah. And you felt it to be a failure or thought it was a critical failure?
It was a total failure.
Yeah.
I have to write my own material or I stink.
I'm talking with Jerry Seinfeld. His new film is called Unfrosted and will continue in just a moment on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes the competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow the competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of the competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and I'm talking today with Jerry Seinfeld. I was going to say the comedian Jerry Seinfeld, but that feels a little New York Timesy, like the renowned physicist Albert Einstein. Seinfeld co-wrote and directed the new film Unfrosted. He's not one of those people who had to find himself exactly. As a kid, Seinfeld fell in love with the comedians on television. And he was still in his 20s when he got a spot on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show.
Would you welcome him, please? Jerry Seinfeld. Jerry.
Wow, good evening. Boy, this is so exciting for me. I'm so excited to be here.
After 9 seasons of Seinfeld, Jerry quit while he was way ahead. He's become a kind of professor of comedy, continuing to do stand-up and shooting the series Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, driving around and joking and analyzing comedy with every great comic of our time. So back to my discussion with Jerry Seinfeld. It's possible that you've probably made a dollar or two from Seinfeld, and yet you still work so hard.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because the only thing in life that's really worth having is good skill. Good skill is the greatest possession. The things that money buys are fine. They're good. I like them. But having a skill, I learned this from reading Esquire magazine. They did an issue on mastery. Do you remember that?
I don't.
I'm surprised. You definitely read Esquire.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
I loved Esquire in the 60s. A magazine for men, remember?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. And they did one issue. In fact, I got to get this issue. I get it on eBay. I'm sure it's there. And it was about, and it's a very Zen Buddhist concept, pursue mastery. That will fulfill your life. You will feel good. Nothing else. I know a lot of rich people, so do you. They don't feel good as you think they should and
right,
would.
Right.
They don't. They're miserable. So I work because if you don't, in stand-up comedy, if you don't do it a lot, you stink.
We call it a phone. We don't even use it as a phone. Nobody's talking on the phone. Once they gave you the option, you could talk or you could type. Talking ended that day. It's over. Talking is obsolete. It's antiquated. I feel like a blacksmith up here sometimes, to tell you the truth. I could text you this whole thing. We can get the hell out of here right now.
Who did you start listening to or watching in comedy and say, that's the skill I want to learn?
Robert Klein and Jay Leno were the two guys that, and George Carlin. Bill Cosby, I loved, but I thought I could never be that good.
Mm-hmm. But I mean as a kid.
You mean like 6, 7?
Yeah, or junior high school or whatever.
I mean, Peter Sellers was a huge obsession of mine as a kid. And there's one line in Unfrosted that a lot of the producers did not like. And they said, you got to take it out. It's too stupid. It really makes no sense at all. And I go, but for 1 second of my life, I got to be Peter Sellers.
What was the line?
The line is at the funeral, and we have this elaborate full serial honors scene, and the widow of...
Say who you're burying.
We're burying Steve Schwinn, who lost his life trying to create the Pop-Tart.
What is happening?
And his wife says to me, looking at this insane ceremony, and she says...
Did you plan this?
And I go, I don't know.
I don't know.
Which is impossible. You can't not know that.
Right.
Either you planned it or you didn't plan it. You can't not know. Inspector Clouseau would say that.
Jerry, tell me about being a beginner, just a funny kid who wants to take the big leap into comedy.
The leap was so terrifying. I don't know why, but I had no confidence in that I might be funny to people that don't know me. And I drove to this club, the Golden Lion Pub, 143 West 44th Street, no longer.
What year?
1975.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still at Queens College. And they have a audition. I think there were just a few people there. And I did this joke about being left-handed, and it got a laugh. And then they booked me on the...
I want to hear the joke.
Okay. The joke is...
So I'm left-handed. Left-handed people do not like that the word left is so often associated with negative things. Two left feet, left-handed compliment. What are we having for dinner? Leftovers. You go to a party, there's nobody there. Where'd everybody go? They left.
No, it's a pretty cute
joke.
It's
not a bad joke.
It's a cute joke.
It's not a bad joke. And how did it go over?
Huge. And it got a huge laugh.
Can you remember the feeling?
Yeah. And the applause. And I, you know that scene in the Elton John movie when he's at the Troubadour? He goes off the ground and the audience comes off the ground. I love that scene. That's what it felt like. I felt like, oh my God, I'm a plane and I just left the ground. I just knew from that moment, that's it. I now know what I will do the rest of my life.
That's incredibly inspiring and at the same time, huge pressure.
Why is it pressure?
Because you then have to write more jokes and repeat it.
The book that got me into comedy is a book called The Last Laugh by Phil Berger. Mm-hmm. I read it in high school. And there's a joke in there that Jimmy Walker told at Catch a Rising Star. It's a pouring, rainy night in Manhattan. He goes on stage. He's soaking wet. He goes, it is raining so hard out there. I just saw Superman getting into a cab. And I read that and I go, how in the world can a brain come up with an idea like that? Mm. I thought that was such, I still love that joke. I love that joke. But I go, how do you think of that? I didn't know how. But when I did the left thing, I went, oh, there's a guy in there that knows how to do it. And he's going to now work his ass off for the rest of my life.
So you became disciplined right away?
Not right away. It was after I saw a comedian do a couple of Tonight shows and get bounced that I realized.
Who was that?
I don't want to mention the name. He went on. He did well. Second time he went on, he did less well. Third time, he struggled, and they never had him back. And I went, oh, now I get how this racket works. This is a writer's game. If you can write, you succeed. If you can't, you will not make it. This, the performing, being funny on stage, that's great. Any comedian can be funny on stage, but the bullets are the writing.
Not long ago, I was watching on YouTube, not for the first time and maybe for the thousandth, Rodney Dangerfield's performances on The Tonight Show, which are insanely good and like filled with rocket fuel.
Yeah.
Well, when I was born, the doctor told my mother I did all I could, but he pulled through anyway, you know? I mean, I don't get no respect from anyone. Well, last week my house was on fire. My wife told the kids, be quiet, you wake up daddy.
So he's a great writer, and he's invented this character, which is himself times 11,
right,
I guess.
Right.
How did you invent how you wanted to be on stage, the persona?
It's like sculpting. Sculpting is removing everything that isn't the sculpture you want to make. You're not adding, you're removing. Stone sculpture, not clay. So when you do a joke and it gets a laugh and something inside you doesn't feel quite right, that you don't do that joke.
Right.
You do the jokes that you feel connect to your anger, your attitude, your personality. You know, success in comedy is very much a conducting. So the face, the voice, the body, the joke. When all of us are working together, it hits, bang. You just feel it. You feel it like hitting a baseball on the button. And when it's a little, one of them is a little off, it's not there.
What do you think about the difference between doing a comedy film for Netflix and doing A Night at the Beacon? It's the same thing, and yet it's not.
I don't. The only similarity is your sense of humor is an essential tool. After that, it's all different. There's no similarity. A Night at the Beacon to me is like being if you're a great jazz player and people come in and they want to hear you play. And you're going on, I'm going, I know this instrument, I'm good at it. Let's all enjoy the playing.
But for the jazz musician or any musician, they want to hear Around Midnight or Born to Run or whatever it is again and again and again. Do you feel that's okay for jokes, or is there constant pressure to make it new and make it new all the
time? We don't have enough time for that conversation. That would take another hour.
What do you mean?
It's a heavy conversation. It's a constant issue in the comedy world. Everybody has a different opinion about it.
Well, give me the short version.
The short version is there's no answer. If I love a bit that somebody does and I go and they do the bit, I love it. If you see them after the show, they go, oh, you did the peanut bit. I love the peanut bit. And you go, I know, I'm trying to get it out of my act and do something new. And go, no, I love that bit. Who's right? There's no answer.
Mm-hmm.
There's no answer. I think if you go see a comedian and he does some great stuff that you know and a bunch of stuff that you don't know, the audience is happy. I think comedians now try so hard to be all new all the time. I think the quality suffers because none of us are really that good. Chris Rock and I have determined that a great comedian working his ass off his entire career writes 2 good hours. The rest is...
Well, how many specials have you done for Netflix?
2.
And
I don't think I'll do another one.
Really?
Yeah.
Why not?
Again, we don't have time for that. These are gigantic subjects in comedy, but I won't put it out there unless I think it's of a certain quality, and I doubt I could get to that in the time I have left. And I don't like old people either. Even though I'm 70, I don't like old people.
You're about to be 70, right?
Whatever.
How are you feeling about that?
I don't care.
Really?
Yeah.
You look good.
Thanks.
You feel good?
Yeah, that's it.
And you're working?
Yeah.
When you say you don't like old men, do you mean that in a kind of Friars Club sort of way?
No, I don't like old people, period. They don't look good. Everything's deteriorating. I don't want to see this. If you want to hang around, fine. But we're moving on to younger people.
Yeah.
I feel like God is like, I'm with you up to about 38.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to stay, you can stay. Mm-hmm. But I'm moving on.
Did you not like old comedians?
No, I love old comedians. Yeah. I do. Because they just get better. This is the great blessing. On the other side of the material torture, on the other side of that, the blessing of it, you just get better and better.
Tell me how you deal with the way the weight of the world or the serious aspects of the world weigh on you and how that affects comedy.
Nothing really affects comedy. People always need it. They need it so badly, and they don't get it. It used to be you would go home at the end of the day. Most people would go, oh, Cheers is on. Oh, MASH is on. Oh, Mary Tyler Moore is on. All in the Family's on. You just expected there'll be some funny stuff we can watch on TV tonight. Well, guess what? Where is it? This is the result of the extreme left and PC crap and people worrying so much about offending other people.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're going to see stand-up comics because we are not policed by anyone. The audience polices us. We know when we're off track.
Mm-hmm.
We know instantly, and we adjust to it instantly. But when you write a script and it goes into 4 or 5 different hands, committees, groups, here's our thought about this joke, well, that's the end of your comedy.
Have you had that experience?
No.
Because isn't that what Curb is all about?
Larry was grandfathered in. He's old enough that I don't have to observe those rules because I started before you made those rules. We did an episode of the series in the 90s where Kramer decides to start a business of having homeless pull rickshaws because, as he says, they're outside anyway.
Mm-hmm. What about the homeless?
Can't we worry about them later?
To pull the rickshaw.
They do have an intimate knowledge of the street.
Oh, he's walking around the city. Why not just strap something to them?
Now, that's the first sensible idea I've heard all day.
Do you think I could get that episode on the air today?
But you think Larry got grandfathered in and there could be no 35-year-old version?
Right. If Larry was 35, he couldn't get away with his, like, the watermelon stuff and Palestinian chicken and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And HBO knows that's what people come here for. But they're not smart enough or to figure out, you know, how do we do this now? Do we take the heat, you know, or just not be funny? We would write a different joke with Kramer and the rickshaw today. We wouldn't do that joke. We'd come up with another joke. They move the gates like in the skiing.
Yeah.
Culture, the gates are moving. Your job is to be agile and clever enough that wherever they put the gates, I'm going to make the gate.
You think this is going away now? This what you're describing as PC is kind of receding?
Slightly. I see a slight movement.
How do you see it?
With certain comedians now, people are having fun with them stepping over the line and us all laughing about it. And but again, it's the stand-ups that really have the freedom to do it because no one else gets the blame if it doesn't go down well. He or she can take all the blame themselves.
Who are the young ones that you like?
Nate Bargatze, I love. Ronnie Chang, I love. Brian Simpson, really funny. Mark Norman, really funny. Sam Morrill, really funny.
Do you ever go to clubs?
Yeah, I go all the time. I don't go and sit there and pay for two drinks and watch and go, this guy's fantastic. No, I go to work out my own stuff.
Jerry, for Unfrosted, you actually wrote a song titled Sweet Morning Heat.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote the lyrics with Jimmy Fallon?
No, I wrote it with Mark Ronson.
Ah.
Jimmy sang it.
By the way, who can sing?
Yeah.
He and Meghan Trainor sang the tune, and Mark and Andrew Watt produced it, right?
Right. But David, when I walked into his studio and I had this piece of paper where I wrote, like, I spent hours on it. Because, you know, there's certain lines you can sing and certain lines you can't. I don't know anything really about singing.
Mm.
And I said to Mark, I wrote these lyrics and I started reading them and he nodded his head and it was a long pause and he went, that's not bad. Oh my God, that was one of the greatest moments of my life.
It's not bad.
Yeah, he said, that's not bad.
Yeah.
I went, really? He said, yeah, that's not bad. We could do some of those. I don't know if you can make out the lyrics when you watch the movie. I haven't seen it in the movie.
That's why I'm asking. Would you like to sing us a little bit?
No, I can't sing.
Can you recite it?
Why?
Jerry Seinfeld, thank you so much. Jerry Seinfeld is the director and star of Unfrosted, and he worked on a TV show called, let me see if I can think of it, Seinfeld. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. It wasn't ever enough. Is there a reason I just can't stay?
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes the competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow the competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of the competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. What is it about Dana-Farber that makes it such a powerful adversary against cancer? It's hundreds of Dana-Farber researchers and clinicians making new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber discoverers. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, nothing is as effective against cancer as a relentless succession of breakthroughs. Go to DanaFarber.org/everywhere and see how what we do here changes lives everywhere.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This week, college campuses all over the country have erupted in protest, with students arrested by the dozens. On our next episode, we'll dive deep into the response to the war in Gaza on university campuses. I'll talk with faculty, a former college president, and student journalists who are covering the unrest on their own campuses.
It has been a tense time, and while there have been unambiguously hateful incidents, both against Jewish students and against Muslim or Arab students or pro-Palestine activists, it's not clear to what extent those represent a systemic problem. And there is no one narrative. In some respects, I think Harvard's campus has actually been comparable to or even calmer than that of many other universities that are also experiencing protests and that are also experiencing pressure as they try to navigate this moment.
That's all next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. If you can name the Secretary of State for whatever state you live in, go ahead and give yourself a gold star in civics. But to be honest, I can't name mine. I can't name any of the other 49 Secretaries of State either. Well, there's one big exception. Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State for Georgia. He became a national figure during a phone call that you probably heard about.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state. And
that was Donald Trump after the 2020 election, and he was in a lousy mood.
You guys are so wrong, and you've treated this, you've treated the population of Georgia so badly. You, between you and your government. But why wouldn't you want to find the right answer, Brad, instead of keep saying that the numbers are right? Because those numbers are so wrong.
After resisting Trump's demands, Raffensperger became the target of death threats from people in his own Republican Party. The phone call is a linchpin in the racketeering case against Trump, led by the Fulton County DA, Fonnie Willis.
So what are we going to do here, folks? I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
Whatever happens in the criminal case, and who knows when it'll come, there's no doubt that Georgia will play a critical role in the election. Once solidly Republican, Georgia went for Joe Biden in 2020 and gave both of its Senate seats to Democrats. And Raffensperger, who enraged the MAGA faction, was easily reelected. But when I spoke with Brad Raffensperger recently, I got a feel for just how precarious a position he's in. He's taking pains not to antagonize anybody in a party that is still overwhelmingly turning out for Donald Trump. There have been multiple recounts, lawsuits, investigations, all confirming that Joe Biden was the winner in the state of Georgia in 2020. Now, Republicans in the state Senate want to investigate you for not overturning the results. What is your life like these days, and when is this going to stop?
Well, right now we're focused on the 2024 elections. We don't look backwards. Some people like to live in the past. We live really in the now. And that's making sure everyone's prepared. We have new congressional districts for 2024, and the counties have those correct. We just finished up our ballot building for the upcoming May primary. So we have that on our plate, and then we're looking at other threat vectors, such as cybersecurity or AI, things like that. So that keeps us busy.
Now, I'm sure it does, and I know your plate is very full with the present tense and the future, and yet people in the Republican Party are all over you about the past. So how do you answer them?
Well, number one, I give them two data points in the 2020 election. We actually had about 33,000 voters, Republican voters, that didn't come back at all to vote in the fall. And then all the voters that did show up, what we noticed that there was 27,900 voters that skipped the top of the ticket. And the Republican congressman got about 27,500 more votes than President Trump. But our job was really to verify the result. All 5 million ballots, they were recounted, a 100% hand recount. And the results were virtually the same. We had some counties that had 3 counts on those ballots, and there was no difference whatsoever.
But you have a party in the state Senate that still wants to investigate you for not overturning the results. What does that tell you about the state of the Republican Party, which you've belonged for a very long time?
Well, I know that if you look at the results of the voters, I believe it was 99% had a good voting experience. They trusted the results and also then just really enjoyed the experience because we've worked hard on making sure we keep those lines short, get the results posted quickly. So the voters give us high marks, and then that's who I work for.
The criminal case against Donald Trump for election interference in Georgia has run into, I think it's no exaggeration to say, serious trouble related to the district attorney there, Fannie Willis. Can that case be salvaged, or is it permanently damaged by questions about Fannie Willis's ethics?
Well, I've been advised that I'm a potential witness for that case, and I've been told that I should not comment further on that case. So that's where I have to leave that today.
Did you ever, in your wildest imagination, think that the issue of voting in the state of Georgia would become the issue it is, both in a serious sense and also the subject of Curb Your Enthusiasm?
You know what? I got some water in the car. Do you want it?
I would love it.
Yeah, here you go. I knew this would come in handy.
Sir, you under arrest for violation of the Election Integrity Act.
What are you talking about?
It is illegal for anyone in the state of Georgia to provide food or water to voters in line at the polls.
What? That's barbaric. What kind of law? Are you serious?
I'm dead serious. You're coming with me.
You can't do... Oh, no, you're making a big mistake.
I'm sorry, baby. I forgot.
I'm not even...
So the so-called violation of giving somebody a bottle of water online becomes a plot point for Larry David.
Well, I'm sure he enjoyed that, and I enjoyed writing my letter back to him. I thought I...
What did you say? What did you say to Larry David?
Well, I told him basically... I'm sorry that he didn't get the warm welcome and VIP treatment that some celebrities and athletic stars get when they spend a few hours in the Fulton County Jail. But here's really the fact about it. This is what's really crazy, is that in New York State, you cannot give anyone a bottle of water within that 150-foot zone.
Yeah, I think it's 100 feet in New York.
And in Georgia, what we found, though, is it wasn't the water issue. It was really politicking issues. People were electioneering within a 150-foot zone. They grab a bottle of water, but then they were coming in emblazoned with their T-shirt, and you know what cause they were supporting. And there they're trying to, quote, touch voters one more time before they went in to vote. And we just want to have that to be just leave people alone, let them make their own decisions. And so that's really why we wanted to clarify that with state law. But really, next year, maybe Larry David would like to go up to New York and talk about their laws. That's his home state, you know. And so
it seems he's retired. Know,
it's kind of like clean up your own house before you start picking on Georgia. You know, we have shown that we have fair, honest, and accurate elections.
Well, when you encounter an election denier in your life, mm-hmm. just out and about, do you find that you can convert an election denier's opinion while you're having a conversation over a cup of coffee or an encounter on the street?
Well, it probably takes more than just 2 minutes. You talk about people switching votes. The first one was that Stacey Abrams. No one wants to talk about that. But after she lost, we had record turnout. We had 4 million people show up for the gubernatorial race in 2018. Record turnout. And she started talking about voter suppression. And she said the machines were flipping the votes. So, you know, and that was with the old machines. And we did not have a verifiable paper ballot. And so
I take your point. But the one difference between Stacey Abrams and President Trump is I don't think you got a phone call from Stacey Abrams trying to lean on you like in something out of Goodfellas or The Godfather.
Well, at the end of the day, what we've shown is that we do have accurate results. And so we have a paper ballot, and you can recount all 100% of them if you want to, if you need to, if it's that close.
Talk to me a little bit about what your life was like for you after the infamous phone call with Donald Trump, when you declined to find in quotes, the 11,000 votes he was asking for. As I understand it, you received death threats. This must have been terrifying to you and your family.
Well, we got all those actually back in November, so and through December. And like I said, it was a shock to the system. You have to think, Georgia had been reliably Republican for 20 years. We had the state house, the state senate, all the constitutional officers. And then all of a sudden, we had this thing, you know, that flipped the other way. But I think if people really were watching what happened in 2018, Stacey Abrams lost by 55,000 votes. And that was actually pretty close because you look at some of the other races. So obviously the Democrats have gained ground. But we expect a big turnout. There's no reason not to expect 5 million voters. We had 5 million show up in 2020 and we had COVID. And doesn't look like things have, you know, decreased in the decibels of our conversation. So it's highly polarized. Anyone can see that. That's not a political statement. That's just a statement of fact.
Do you ever worry about what might happen in the state if Donald Trump does not take the state this time?
No, because I believe at the end of the day, the voters decide these things and we can verify every single vote. But you have to understand, we don't use signature match as the primary means of identifying our absentee ballots. It's photo ID. And that has just increased people's confidence net. And that's something we actually pulled from Minnesota, which is a Democrat state, Kansas, and Nebraska. Those states have been using that for years.
Sir, Donald Trump was talking about rigged elections in 2016. You knew they weren't rigged. You kept faith in him. You voted for Donald Trump in 2020. Will you do so in November?
Well, now that I'm Secretary of State, I've made my position that I don't endorse candidates because I want voters to understand I'm the chief election official for the state. It did get me in trouble in 2020 that I didn't endorse, you know, Donald Trump as the candidate. Yes, I did vote for him. I shared that so people understood when I did my job, there's no animosity. No, I'm a conservative Republican. I voted for the team. I want everyone in the state of Georgia to understand we're going to have a fair, honest election, and it's up to the candidates to turn out their people.
But you were in a unique position. You had a president of the United States call you up and lean on you in the most overt way to distort an election, and I just wonder how that did or did not change your view of him.
I wanted to make sure I gave him the information point by point about where we were and why all those allegations. When he mentioned that there's 5,000 dead people, I told him that there's two. Since then, we found two more. So there's, but it was really the points that he raised, and we just wanted to go back point by point and just let him know that.
But he wasn't calling you on the level of information. He could have had any aide do that. He was calling you to lean on you.
Well, we had the data on our side. My job is to follow the law, follow the Constitution. But like I said, when we started this off, I'm focused really on 2024.
Given what happened in 2020, let's not talk about you for a moment, but to Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss, who were election workers working honestly, who were falsely accused of stealing votes in Georgia. How do you feel about what happened to Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss, for example?
Around the week of January 6th, the FBI informed me that I needed to leave my home for safety. I stayed away from my home for approximately 2 months. I felt homeless. I felt, I can't believe this person has caused this much damage to me and my family to have to leave my home, that I've lived there for 21 years.
I've been really clear about that. That was, you know, incredibly unfortunate. It's horrifying. It had been investigated thoroughly, and they didn't do anything wrong. We looked at it with our investigators. The GBI looked at it. The FBI looked at it. People say, oh, you can't trust the FBI anymore. But guess who else looked at it? President Trump's handpicked U.S. attorney, Bobby Christine. And he found nothing either.
But considering what happened to Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss, which sounds terrifying.
It was.
Have you been having any trouble recruiting election workers?
We've done a great job of recruitment. Could we use a few more? Yes. We're probably good at all the county levels because people look at it as a way that it's a way for them to give back to their community.
You've been a Republican all your life. You voted for Republican candidates, obviously. And yet I wonder how your view of Donald Trump's honesty or dishonesty was affected by the phone call that you received.
Well, my role model has always been a conservative role model. I grew up with Ronald Reagan, and really he had a captivating personality. He was a committed conservative, but he also had charm. When I was younger, sometimes it would frustrate me that, you know, Reagan would go ahead and reach across the aisle and talk to Tip O'Neill, but he was older and wiser than me, and now I understand the wisdom of Reagan on that, because if you want to get things done in Congress, you do have to reach across. You want to get as much as you can
to your side.
It's interesting.
What you're talking about reaching across the aisle is the kind of rhetoric and practice of Joe Biden that he's criticized for sometimes within the Democratic Party. It sounds like you have some affection for Biden's point of view on this.
No, I have affection for Ronald Reagan. Because
he's not on the ballot, sir.
No, I know. But he kind of embodied the American spirit. And I think that's what people really want, is that spirit of freedom, liberty, you know, smaller government, but make sure it's efficient. We do have a role for government, but it has to be efficient with taxpayer dollars and really serve people. And people need to be served.
Mr. Raffensperger, I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Be well.
Take care.
I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for today. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado, Louis Mitchell, and Jared Paul. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, Jared Paul, and Alicia Zuckerman, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Michael May, David Gable, Alex Parrish, Victor Guan, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.